elderly people. And they were traveling around. They went over to Spain around. They went on a little island over there. And happened to be that this little island, Portuguese island, that the governor of the island was a relative of my father's. My daughter ran into him over there. Well, so did she. She had a wonderful time. And she, in fact, she came back now. I just got a letter from a few days ago that she's back over there visiting again. And they just went overboard over there, took them out fishing, and all the people hugged them and kissed her and all this stuff, you know. And she just had a wonderful time.
That was in Portugal.
Yeah. And this, oh, it's over in, that like that. See, gal, what are
she gonna see you bake today?
Oh, I just, well, I just.
And just ask you a few questions on. I've already read this article from the Alaska Sportsman, so that gives a little bit of background on your father. But you said that he was going to university. He was a university student in Spain.
Yeah, student in Spain, and he met this young college boy there with him. He was a Spanish boy, and
was he a student also?
He was a student, and as I say, he had a relative in Butte, Montana. And so I talked to my father and going. My father was, as I say, he didn't believe in this royalty deal where they have to marry into certain families and all this, you know, the tradition. And and he said his idea was that he didn't like the way they're living. They said the rich were living off the poor, and he didn't believe in that. That was his philosophy in life. And
How old was he when he left?
He was 19 years old.
19?
Mm-hmm. I have a picture of him upstairs someplace. And so they went to Butte, and as I say, my uncle there, my mother's brother, was assistant superintendent of Anaconda Copper Mine there at that time. That's where they met.
Did your father speak English at that time?
Oh, yeah, he could speak a little. In fact, he could speak 7 different languages.
Probably, being in the royalty,
superb schooling. Yeah, that's right. And you care for that?
No, thank you.
And so finally landed here in Juneau in 95, and they were here for the year, and then went to Skagway, and they opened up a restaurant there in the Baker Shop. And from there,
the Baker Shop?
A Baker Shop.
Oh, bakery.
Probably you. You know where the fire, well, you have been in Skagway, by the way, you know where the old fire hall used to be? Out on Front Street, what they call Front Street,
yeah,
before the tower, where that old fire wagon and everything is.
Yeah, right.
Well, right across there's an old building there that's pretty well caved now. It's just with a aluminum top on it. They had a bigger shop on one side and the rest in there. In fact, that's where I lost this finger and this one, part of this one there. In that place, and when I was just a youngster. And then from there, they went to Dawson then, and he opened up his baker shop there and restaurant there in Dawson.
Did he walk over the trail?
Yeah, he went over the trail in 98.
'98.
And my brother was, he packed my brother over the trail. He was three and a half years old when he went over there.
And your mother walked?
She went over the trail too in the early days. And
what's your brother's, was your brother's
Frank,
name?
Frank. Frank Sylvester was my brother's name, and mine is Emmett Manuel. And so then I was there for a long time in the restaurant business there, and then finally my father went mining. They went up in Quartz Creek. But we first at Dominion there. We was there for a long, about
well,
a year.
Let's get back to you. You weren't born yet.
Oh, well, yeah, I was born in 1900.
1900 in Dawson. Well, when your mother and father and then your brother was about 3 and a half, you said,
yeah,
in 98. So then you were born in 1900.
July the 4th.
July 4th,
1900.
So you're a Canadian by birth.
By birth, yeah, that's right.
Your mother is American by birth.
Yeah, by birth.
Your father is Spanish.
Spanish by birth.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Did you all end up to be American citizens?
We all came up to be American citizens.
Yeah. So yeah. when they first went to Dawson, did they have a bakery, a big
bakery shop and restaurant.
And a restaurant.
That was right on Front Street, as I say, right across from the old fire hall.
That was in Dawson.
Yeah. Oh, you're referring to Skagway first?
No.
I was in Dawson. Yeah.
Well, what did they call their place in Dawson?
It was the Pioneer's Inn, I think is what they called it that day.
Pioneer's Inn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Early days.
They ran that for...
They had that for about four or five years. And then from there we went up, and moved up to Hunker for a short time, mining up there. Mm-hmm. And then... And from there, my father and mother, we moved up to Quartz Creek.
Now, where is that from Dawson?
That's 54 miles out of Dawson.
Up the Klondike?
Up the Klondike.
To Quartz Creek.
Quartz Creek. And my father had mining claims there. And we had, one time we had 65 men working for my father in the mine there. And then they got in litigation with the Guggenheims. They wanted to buy our property, and I can remember that well, and they came in there with $150,000 in gold dust and laid it on the table, my father and mother. In fact, my mother, I don't think was any miner in the Yukon that wore a pair of pants that knew mining as well as my mother. And she absolutely knew it was, that the mine was worth really more than that, and they wouldn't sell it. So there was an old gentleman that had some claims right next to us. We had 11 claims, and he had number 12, 13, 14. And he was in the hospital on his deathbed. So the Blankman was the recorder for the Guggenheims, and he went up and he bought this claim from this, these claims from this man was on his deathbed. So then they drove a shaft, mine shaft down there, and tunneled into our property and got us in litigation. So we had to go to court, and we lost our first case in Dawson.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, and then my mother appealed to Ottawa, and we won the case. But it was tied up from 1914, and it's never been operated since. It's been tied up all that time. We had brand new machinery and everything up there, and it still was in its crates and it's rotted and just laying there.
Well, do you still own the property?
I'm still on the property. This was people, a friend of mine from Douglas over here, just went up here a few years ago, and I gave him all the papers, and he went to the mining claims in Dawson to the White Horse and went all through the files and everything. He's going up this year to look it over.
So you still have those 11 claims?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Still tied up in there. And
well, did your mother, she came from a mining family. Did she have a mining education? Did she study?
No, she never, but, this
but she just had grown
just
up
grown,
in it.
Grown up in it and knew mining pretty
knew
well.
Well,
so,
yeah.
You know, and so then we got tied, as I said, we got tied up in litigation there, and the war broke out in 14 and just kept on plowing. We had all the water rights for all the, there's maybe 60 or 90,000, maybe more than that. At that time, we left in funds that used for our water rights that we can't touch. And so they just, every time they come up for a pay, they just snatch a little big mining company, they just postponed it, and that's what we've been just laying that way ever since.
Since 14.
Yeah,
so
it's 1914.
That's 60 years. 60 years.
No, six. Yeah.
This is 1974.
So, yeah, it was 6 years.
It'll be 60 years.
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
Well, is there a chance that you might go back in there yourself and do some work on it
No, not me.
If it's valuable gold property, I
well,
think
we,
it's...
Well, the idea, if we can sell it, that's what I'm... My idea is, even with the officer... offer half of what they did before, I'd take and be satisfied rather than you know, and lose it. But get nothing out of it. But as I say, they just, things kept that way in litigation all the time and nothing you can do about it.
So that was in 1914, so how much, then what did you do?
Well, as I say,
you
then,
stay in the Dawson area?
Yeah, you know, we stayed there, and my mother and I came out in 1913 and came to Juneau, and my father and brother came out in 1915.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been here ever since, and doing never left. And I made my first trip to the States in 1948.
Is that right?
Went down in one boat and come back in the same one. It was not for me. I stayed there
you
one
went
day.
To Seattle?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's all you saw was Seattle?
Yeah. And then I went in 1915 and I was with the state, with the highway, or the state police. I took prisoners out to Los Angeles in 57. And I was just there 2 days, and I came home. I'd never been out since.
Kind of frightening it. When you look at all those people.
Yeah, traffic. And,
especially
you know,
when you
everybody,
fly over and see those big cities and multiply all the sea people.
The pill, that's right. And everybody's in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
And the first trip I went to Seattle, and down the streets, knowing people would crowd around the bump, and I said, pardon me, excuse me, and I'm just wasting my time. They didn't give it a dime for me.
Well, when you came here in 1913, then you were 13 years old.
Yes, that's right.
So what, had you had some schooling in Dawson? Did your mother teach you, or did you go to school in Dawson?
No. Well, I went to a school there in the Catholic school for 2 years.
The Catholic school.
That's
still standing, I think.
Yeah, it's still
there. I was
there
last summer, and someone showed us the Catholic school. There was a Catholic school, a public school, and I think one other, wasn't there?
Yeah, there's one other. The Methodist, I think. No, Salvation Army opened that their school at that time. I don't know what since that. And
did you go to school in Juneau when you came here?
Well, I was here for, I went to school for 2 years, and I fell and got hurt. And I stayed out, and all my education I got is from home. And my mother taught me everything. And
when your father came back, your father and older brother came from Dawson down here to Juneau. What, where did you settle? Right in town in Juneau?
We settled right in town.
Mm-hmm.
And my father, mother, and brother all died in Juneau.
I see.
And I didn't get married till I was 48. And I built this before I got married, and I was down here in 39 when I put this place
you
up.
You built this in 39. Is this Auk Bay out here? Or
no, Auk Bay is.
We came past
stores and everything is down there.
Is this your name for this?
This is Lena Point.
Lena Point.
Yeah, D Harbor, Lena Point.
When you built this in 1939, was there a road out
to Spark? No, there was no road over here at all. It was up where you picked me up, but there was no this way at all, and no road, and I packed everything over my back.
I see.
And built this, and now going back to Dawson, Robert Service, we lived, our home was just about, I'd say a quarter of a block from where he lived.
Is that right?
And he was quite a wonderful man. And he was fond of children. Now, there were five of us lived in that neighborhood right close. And he went out one morning and he took an old oil can, an old 5-gallon can, cut it, made a door, and put a stove in. And he'd go out there and he'd bake hotcakes for us. And make baked potatoes. And he'd get out and recite poetry and poems to us, you know. And as I say, he was just a wonderful man, there was no question about it. And then he went out when the war broke out in 1917, he went out with the Dawson Battalion, the Princess Pat.
Mm-hmm.
And he went over to France and got married there after the war with a French girl, and he's never returned.
He died over there in the Riviera,
Riviera, I think it was. I think his wife, I understand, is still living.
Yes, I believe so, unless she has died in the last year or so.
But we used to, as I say, my folks and all, I thought the world of them. And,
have you been back to Dawson in recent years?
I was back in 48, or 68.
68.
Wait, my youngest daughter, Joy, and my wife and I went back. We drove in there on Discovery Day
in
68.
68.
And I tell you, it was quite a difference to see that old town all turned upside down.
I went in there last August.
Oh.
During Discovery Day week, and I went with Mrs. Coyle. I think you might know her. Adriana Coyle.
Coyle,
She went to Dawson in 1900. She was 4 years old then, and lived there. I'm not sure what year she left, but you might have known her as a child.
Yeah, I remember, I got a picture where we had our confirmation in the Catholic school, in the church, a lot of the old time, I was looking through here not too long ago, and I think there's about 40, 45 that was in that. There's only about 10, 11, 11 today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I went over there at Discovery Day this last year with Mrs. Coyle and two other friends of mine from Fairbanks. All of us belonged to Pioneers over there. We really had a wonderful trip, and she knows so many of the people mm-hmm. in Dawson because she lived there when she was a child, and then she's made quite a few trips back. So she's retained a relationship and friendship uh-huh. there with many of those people. And it was just like having a key to the city for us. Because we were strangers to those mm-hmm. people in Dawson. And they were so nice to us. It was just great. Just typical Alaskan hospitality. Yeah,
they really, well, for but anybody that's old-timers, so that anybody goes there that visits them, they'll just turn the town over to them.
Yeah. But they're doing a lot of historical preservation work there now. Were you aware of that?
No.
They started in, let's see, well, you went in 68.
No, excuse me. No, I think they had that new museum, just finished it, and was bringing all the artifacts and everything of the old-timers.
Yeah,
and bringing in there
because
just
in 67 they celebrated their Canada's centennial.
The centennial, that's right.
Same as our Purchase Centennial in Alaska.
Yeah.
That's right. And then they had... didn't they have the Grand Palace Theater redone then? They had that, and then they started the museum, uh-huh. and then they ran out of funds, and they had to get historical preservation funds from Ottawa, because they didn't have the money. There were only 600 people or so in that area now. And so it took them, maybe 3 or 4 years, no longer than that. But they have the program going again, and they are restoring... They've restored the steamer Kino, and it's right on the bank, old Canadian bank. They've restored several buildings, and they're in the process of restoring several others. They've got it's a total of about a $10 million project.
Wow.
It's just a wonderful thing. But people would go into Dawson and pick up odds and ends and take them with them, you know. And the scroungers were just stealing
blind. Yeah,
hopefully we can do a little bit of that in Alaska.
Yeah.
I was looking down Main Street. I went down to see Mary Joyce at the Lucky Ladies Bar. I wanted to set up an appointment with her because she mushed a team of dogs up to Fairbanks in 1936.
Yeah.
I want to get her to talk about it. And I was, as I walked down that main street there from the Baranoff Hotel, there's some old buildings there.
Oh yeah, there's
some. I hope they historically they don't tear everything down.
Well, they're doing it though. That's the worst part of it.
But there's some beautiful old structures there.
They're tearing them down. It's terrible.
Well, I have to talk.
And then going back in Dawson again, let's say in the early days there is. George Black was the governor at that time when we was there, and he was pretty close neighbors of ours.
At that time, Dawson was the capital of the Yukon.
The Yukon, And the early days there, as it says in there, the population there was about 60,000 people living in tents.
Yeah.
As I say, back in Corsicook, mother and I and my brother had a close call. My father went to Dawson and Mitty Russo, he was our foreman, and they go in about every month and get groceries and provisions and bring them up in the dog teams, you know. And my father was going over the trail and he got pneumonia, and he was in the hospital there. So Mitty Russo turned around when I came back with the dog team and told my mother that we'd better get down there. My father in pretty low condition, and some other gets the dog team up. We had 9 dogs. And our leader was a female, and she was half wolf. Wonderful dog. Couldn't beat her. We'd race every year with the Northwest Mounted Police in there, and we'd generally win 1 year, they'd win the next.
Yeah.
You know. So we got on the trail and got up on the dome. I guess you know heard of that. And we got in a snowstorm there and got caught. But luckily, about 30 miles out of Dawson, where the slaughterhouse used to be, they had a roadhouse, and there was friends of our folks. And this... Mitty Russo, our foreman, told him that we sure didn't expect us, that we'd be along any time. So we got within about 3 or 4 miles of the boathouse, and we run into a pack of wolves.
Mm.
About 40, 50 in a pack.
Holy smoke.
And my brother had a 30-30 at that time, and he kept shooting, and I think he killed 4 or 5, as far as my mother could say, and they just, you know, bang, and out they go. And they kept on shooting, and they had this roadhouse heard us shooting, and then they just opened up the big doors in the dining room. My mother drove dog team and all right in there, and if we had another minute or so to go, I wouldn't have been here to tell the story.
Is that right? You mean the wolves were attacking?
Oh, yeah, attacking. They'd strip horses. I've got 2 instances that I know I can remember where people being a cutter and going to some roadhouse or something around and leave it.
And they'd strip
the horse right out of the harness. They'd run in 40 and 50 in a pack.
Is that right?
Big ones, too.
Well, did they have any professional wolf hunters around to...
No, they didn't. You had to take care of yourself.
Take care of yourself.
That was it.
I never heard of a pack of wolves that big.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. You care for more coffee?
No, thank you.
And so I say we had a couple close calls there.
My gosh.
And...
What did the wolves do to the dog team? Did they... Kill any of the dogs?
Oh no! Mother drove the dog team and all the other right in the roadhouse, so they didn't get a chance of them. But if we'd been, as I say, 2 or 3 minutes farther to go before we got there, I'm afraid we wouldn't have made it.
Yeah, holy smoke!
Yeah, yeah. And did you ever hear of that O'Brien murder, the early days?
I've heard of it, but I don't recall any details.
Well, my father had the restaurant in Dawson. This O'Brien used to eat at my father's place. My father had the big St. Medard dog. He brought it in the interior with him when he went in. And this O'Brien was pretty fond of the dog, and actually he'd eat our place, and he'd pet the dog and feed it, you know, out of the kitchen and everything. So the two miners went out after they made their big cleanup, and they had about... $200,000 in gold dust, and this O'Brien followed them out on the trail, and he stole my father's dog, took him with him. The dog left them and came back into Dawson. My father was frying some hotcakes in the morning, and the dog went up to him, kept pulling on him, you know. And so the Sergeant Mapley, the North Westmoreland Police, he went in with my father when he was young. That young man, he was always, it's like a son. My dad was like a father to him. My dad said, "There's something wrong." He said, "If you better take that dog and follow him." That dog absolutely took him away where he'd murdered these two people, these two men. And they finally got him. They got these fellas. They got this O'Brien.
O'Brien. Where was he? Where'd they catch? He was headed out of the country.
Oh yeah, but there was a couple of years before they got him. I don't exactly where. Well, I understood one time that it was over in China. They followed him, leaving China.
Is that right?
And
they located. Yeah.
And we left. My father and brother left in 1915. They gave the dog to the North Westmoreland Police and. He even took two of them in there that went snowblind, took them back into Dawson. These two Mounties had them, and the dog took them back. And they buried them right there in Northwest Mounted Police.
In their graveyard. What was the dog's name?
Prince.
Prince. Yeah. It was St. Bernard.
St. Bernard.
And your father took him in 98, was
yeah.
it?
When, yeah. Took him in the interior with him.
Is it?
Yeah, oh. From Skagway.
Yeah. Well, if your father went to Skagway and came to Juneau in 95, was it? To Juneau in 95, and then the next year,
it went 96, to Skagway. And so
he was there when Soapy Smith bit the dust.
Oh, yeah. He was, as I say, they used to eat at my father's place, both of them.
Yeah.
And it was
Frank Reed?
Reed.
And
yes,
Soapy Smith?
Yes, all such stories in there, too.
Yeah.
And it was just, as she said, maybe, that's... Where the saloon was, or the little saloon, that's only about a half a block, I think, so, where mm-hmm. the shooting took place.
Do you recall any stories your father told about Soapy Smith?
No, I actually don't. The only thing they say that he always ate there, and he naturally talked to him and all that
mm-hmm.
stuff, and,
mm-hmm.
and knew he was a gambler and everything else. As far as him ever making remarks or talking about him, I don't know if you can't recall it.
Now, your wife, you met her in, is she an Alaskan, born in Alaska?
No, she's from, she was born in Butte, or not in Butte, but in South Dakota.
But you met her in Alaska?
Did she? Yeah, she came here and was That's where I met my wife here.
You said you didn't go outside until 1948. Yeah, so.
Yeah, and then my father died here, and my brother and mother. My mother died in 29. My father died in 46. My brother in 48.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, I got two girls and a son.
Okay, you have two. What are your children's names?
My son is Bruce.
And he's the one that you say you're studying for law degree.
Law.
Mm-hmm.
Well.
Your son Bruce is studying.
Studying law.
Studying law. Willamette. And Kathy is the one who's traveling.
You're traveling around, yeah. Yeah, and, time for a life.
Julie, is she here in Juneau?
No, she's at Willamette studying school.
Well, she's
now
at the university. Yeah,
excuse me, it's the first year.
I see. Yeah.
She's going to study law too. We just got a letter, and mother says she decided to study law. That's where we're going down to visit them, and they'll both be back within a month. Then the school will be over,
yeah,
and
you know,
for their spring vacation.
So you're just going down for a
short visit.
Yeah. Now from Juneau to Seattle and Portland, that area, it's not very far, but from Fairbanks,
oh, yeah, it's
a major trip.
Yes, it is.
When your father came back to Juneau, did I ask you this question before? I can't recall. What did business did he go into?
He didn't go in, just retired.
Mm-hmm. So at that time...
No, I'm wrong, too. We had a restaurant for about a year and a half, and then my father sold out, and that was...
Mm-hmm.
Around 1918, had the restaurant for a year and a half, and he sold.
And how old was he?
He was 84 when he died.
So your father, what?
No, he's 86, rather. I'm getting it right. So he was 86 years old when he passed away.
And you say he died in the 20s? 46. Oh, 46, and he was 86 years old.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My brother died in 48, spring of 48.
Okay, and his name was
Frank Sylvester.
And your mother died in
29.
Yeah. Then you said that you made your first trip outside in 1948, and You said you took a prisoner out for the station?
No, at that time I just went out
just for a visit.
For a visit.
To see the big outside world.
Yeah. And I went on one, as I say, I went on one boat and came back in the same one. I was in there in 2 days. That was enough for me.
Yeah.
Get down there, and traffic was too much, and there was, as I say, the people, they had no respect for you at all. Why they didn't give it, I'd say, pardon me, excuse me, you're bumping me, I'm just wasting my time.
Yeah. But what did you do after you came back here to Juneau? Did you go on to school, or did you learn a trade, or?
Well, no. My brother and I, we was contracting here. We filled all the streets in Juneau from the AJ Rock. When they were using the mine, we contracted filling all the streets. We filled it all up as far as where the bridge is.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, my brother went and done a little mining around, and we went up the Taku River and done a little mining up in there at that time. Gold mining. Yeah, I came back, and then another young fellow and I went in. We ended up where the Triangle Bar is now. We bought that, and we opened that up at that time. I had that for five years, and then I joined the police department here, and I was in that for 5 years, and I was chief here for a year. And then in 43, I was hired by the state at that time to the police. No, it wasn't. Yeah, no, it was the highway patrol at that time.
Oh, highway patrol. Mm-hmm.
And then, when I went over to the state police, I went in there and I put in 20. I retired in 1961 as lieutenant. When I retired.
So you went with the wasn't the territorial
highway patrol?
Highway patrol in 43.
Mm-hmm. When it first opened.
And then you transferred
to
when we became a state, you
stayed
went on,
into the
stayed in.
Stayed into it.
And you retired in
61. I used to travel. I went when I was in anchorage I was in in charge of all outlying decks. I had to keep now Homer, Surrey, Bell, East, Clean, and the Fairbanks.
Oh, so you lived in the Anchorage area then?
Oh, I was there 7 years in Anchorage.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, out at City View.
And your family was there with you?
Oh, yes.
Did you have your house boarded up, or did you have someone renting it here?
I had rented it here, which I regretted many times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have a log house in Fairbanks, and our son is 19 and a half, and is going to get, he wants to go up north and work on the road jobs or the pipeline project. And our daughter is 17, and she's going to be going off to college here pretty soon, so we're going to have it's just about four times too big.
Yeah.
No.
Sure, that's right.
So I don't know what we're going to do. But it's been nice having lots of room for them, because they had plenty of room when they were small.
My daughter, I know, I just got this letter from her the day before yesterday, and I don't know where she ever got the information. She was just saying where she sat down and crying and crying for about 3-4 days. She got the information that we was tearing this down. I don't know where my son there. I wrote to my son, and he said he never said where she ever got it. I don't know. Maybe some of our native or friends that wrote to her, you know, kids or something, that mentioned it. And she was recalling all the happy days that she's had here and all this. One of me trying to send her some pictures so she could recall the past days and all, you know. So I wrote to her and told her, oh, you don't have to worry about ever tearing it down.
Yeah.
It was a few years ago, we were talking about selling the kids in, but all three of us went up in the area, you know, they can't sell the place. So.
Do you get outside very often to visit?
No. Well, we was out 2 years ago to visit the youngsters, or my son, when he graduated from college. Have you got a few minutes, and I'll tell you a little story here.
Oh, okay. Do you want to...
No, well, no, it wouldn't interest. No, it's not regarding the...
this at all. These tapes will...
Yeah.
We'll just do them for the Historical Society, and then we'll turn them over to the historical section at the library at the university.
Yeah.
So, anytime we say somebody says something, he doesn't want anybody to hear, well, we just...
Well, I mean, I don't, as far as I go, I mean, I want to start something going. I mean, you know, it could start a little friction.
Well,
now when I...
You worked with the Highway Patrol, and you were just telling me there a minute ago about... here in this this
section here is Tea Harbor.
It's Tea Harbor. Well, anyway, this young couple came out and they stayed here on their honeymoon.
Well, when I was building this place, I used to hear these high-powered motors running at night.
And that was in
39. And as I say, I could hear them. A lot of times I thought it would slide, and I'd run back out here and look up on the hill and couldn't see nothing in a half hour or so, and it would all pass away again. So I'd heard that for, maybe a month or so. Then finally, when I was on the police department, I told you one story was wrong. I was on the city police that time. And this young fellow that worked with me on the police department got married, and he said, I'd like to go out, spend my honeymoon at your place. It's all right with you. I says, fine, come on out. So they were here, and his wife. And we were sitting by the window one morning having breakfast, and when I got through, I went on the hill, and I was doing some burning and cleaning and all this stuff, and his wife, Vi, she came up and hollered at me, said, something funny here. I'm going to come down and take a look. So I came down the front of the house, and this, the only way we noticed was the tide was going out that time. So here comes the tree around Shelter Island, around the Point Louisa.
Mm-hmm.
Come in and made a circle around the bay in here, went back out in front of my place, and with a tree pushing the water. So they asked me at that time, what do you think it is? And I said, well, it looks like, the only thing to me, it looks like a submarine with a conning tower with a tree over the conning tower.
Yeah.
Conning tower. And I said, well, I said it could be possible. And I said, well, I don't want to go in to start a rumor regarding this. So I let it pass for quite a while. And a month later, then I was transferred over to the Highway Patrol. So I stopped at Dock Bay, and Colonel Rieger was in charge of the Army. The Army just moved in here at that time. And so I had a cup of coffee with him. He asked me where I was going, and I said, I'm going out to scout camp. And he said, gee, I wish I could go with you.
Was that out past here?
Oh, yeah, that's way out in the road, about 23 miles. And he said, well, he said, sometime, he says, if you've got time, like when I get settled, I'd like to have you drop by and take me out the road and show me around. And I says, fine, I'll certainly do that. So I left. He stayed there. He said, I've got some officers coming over from the Excursion Inlet, and I've got to stay here and wait and see them. So I drove out, and I got to my place, and I stopped here and had some coffee. And when I got through, I went out, started out to the scout camp, and I got up as far as the Inspiration Point up near the road, about a mile from here, and looked out in the channel, and here's this tree going up the channel again. So I turned around, went right back to Hawk Bay, and I told the colonel what I'd seen, and I said, I'd like to get a pair of high-powered glasses and go out and take a look. And he said, Emmett, well, he said, never mind the glasses. He said, you head into town and get a hold of Mr. Schottler. He's aide to the governor at Greening, and he's head of the Coast Guard. And have him get a ship or a fast boat come out here and meet me. And he said, you stay here too at the same time. So I did. And when we got out, they went over to this island over there, as I say, and we could see smoke coming out of the chimney. And they knew there was a submarine here. The Army knew at that time. And that's why they moved in. They knew it. But that's why the Army and everything moved in here and put their camp here out at Duck Creek. They had about, I think it was 550 men or something like that time. And during that time, everything went by here. For the United States Army went by here to go up to Kiska
and Fort Rich
and all, but everything was supposed to go out then to the Aleutian Islands and to Kiska. All the freight went by here 24 hours a day, and this Japanese sub was in here, was a reconnaissance net taking contact with all those things going by. So after they go over that island, they say they would see the smoke on there in the island. They got on there, and it was a long house over there built. And no windows, and just one door. But these Japs are supposed to go fishing all the time. They go out here and rent a boat, go to fishing. And they had their headquarters, and the submarine was over the other side. And they'd come up at night when the tide was low and get on this ramp and charge their batteries. And the Japs would go out and hire boats and go fishing. And that was their headquarters over on this island, and made their contract there.
Now, the ones who rent the boats, there were Japanese who lived here in Juneau, the Juneau area?
Yeah, well, from here in Petersburg, Wrangell, and all over through Alaska.
And they all just over. Come over here and rent
boats? They come
boats
in and make their contact every so often.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, they went over there and broke this door in, big long table with leather chairs, big conference table there with literature and everything on there, and that was their contacts. And this one Jap, we used to call him Concrete, that we named him that, he was supposed to be a gambler, and he'd come up here for years, 4 or 5 years before the war ever broke out, and his headquarters was in Portland, and he was intelligence officer for the Navy, for the Navy.
Japanese, yeah.
And he'd make all it from Portland on. He'd make all his canvas to Sitka, Petersburg, Wrangell, Juneau, Fairbanks, travel all around and go into Anchorage and then go back. And so that's the way things happened at that time.
Oh, be darned. That's amazing.
And as I say, people out here that lived here didn't know a thing about it.
Well, did the Coast Guard...
But they finally said they sunk they sunk the sub after they had one. There's two of our local boys that was on the, but I don't know what they call them, depth finder,
depth chargers
or anything. And they're on this boat, and they sank this sub off of Icy Straits.
That's some story.
Yeah.
That must have been the sight, seeing that tree.
But we probably wouldn't have noticed it if the only thing that the tide was going out, the tree wouldn't be coming in by itself when the tide's going out. The only way that we happen to notice it, because the tide was going out.
And then you said later that you overheard some Japanese talking about Pearl Harbor.
Oh, yeah, that was on the Pearl Harbor deal,
These Japanese then were in all these communities in southeastern Alaska, and then they would come.
They come in there. They make their, as I say, when they go supposed to be going fishing and all this stuff. They happened to be in the city cafe in the tap zone at that time. And this young chap, I hadn't seen him for a couple of years, and he was waiting on the table. And as I say, I asked him, I said, "Well, where have you been so long? I haven't seen you for quite a while." He said, "Well, all I do," he says, "I've been down in Peterburg Wrangell, and all I do is point out a certain chap." He says, "I work for that man there, and I take photographs." He says, "He owns a photograph, and I just take pictures of inlets, canneries, all the different waters and everything around, where, you know, where the subs could go and everything." And he said, "That's all I do for 2 years." And then I asked him, I says, "What's the idea of the congregation, all these Japanese here in the back?" I said, "There's at least 10 or 12 back there." And he says, "Well," he said, "it's a custom." He says, "There's a young fellow there getting married." And he says, "It's a custom in our country when one of our relatives get married that we all get together and are going to have a wedding." Well, in between the conversation a little later on, as I say, I was sitting there having my coffee, and I heard one of these Japs make this mention that they're going to bomb Pearl Harbor on the 7th of December. And I said, when I got through, I immediately drove up to the Cashin Hotel, and I knew one of these FBI officer was there living, and I got him out of bed, and I explained to him what I'd heard, and I said that was the end of it. That's the last I ever heard of it.
And then on the 7th of December.
That's when they bombed Pearl Harbor.
When did you hear it? Was it just about a month or two before, or a few weeks?
Well, I'd say it was about month before.
About a month before.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I was out on the Aleutians in January, first time I ever went out there. I'd probably never get another chance to go. But we stopped at Adak and then went on to Shimya and Attu, just, you know, on the plane and came back. But out at Shimya, there's, well, a lot of those places. There's World War II stuff that's still there.
Oh, still there, I don't doubt it.
And I picked up the seatbelt out of a P-38, P-38 airplane.
Well,
old Quonset huts in the sitting there in the hills.
Yeah.
Coca-Cola bottles, thousands of Coca-Cola bottles in the garbage dump.
Well,
just
that's regular historic itself.
It's really historic. Yeah, there's lots of things there that should be preserved.
Yeah, I think
there's a lot of junk there and old barrels and things that should be cleaned up, but. When you stop to think about the Japanese occupying the Aleutians and how close they could have come to occupying all of Alaska.
And we had some wonderful officers, as I say, during the war here. I was lucky when I was in the police department chief here. They had 150 soldiers over at Excursion Inlet during the war that were from every penitentiary in the United States.
Is that right?
Every Saturday night, they turned 150 loose in town. And at my jail, I could hold 35 prisoners, and I'd have that full in 2 hours. And finally, they built me a stockade down where the Winter Pond building is down there. They built a stockade. And I'd have that full. They had no respect for their officer. They'd strip their own officer on the street because they had nothing to lose. They're from penitentiary anyhow. So they didn't have nothing to lose.
Well, what kind of a... Were they special?
Well, in work battalion.
Work battalion.
They put them in work battalion.
Yeah.
As I say, we had, if I didn't have some wonderful officer, this Captain Donnell, he was provost marshal. And Mike Montgomery, he was a Captain Montgomery, and Captain Smith, and two or three other, two of them was killed up in the Aleutians.
Mm-hmm.
And if I didn't have those men in this town, we'd never survive. That was all there was to it.
That must have been a wild Saturday night.
Oh, it was terrible. And then, so one time, a troop ship came in one time with 700 men on it, the Charleston, anchored down here in the bay. And I heard the loudspeakers blasting, but I couldn't hear, I didn't pay any attention to what they were saying. So they turned off all those 700 men loose in town.
Holy smoke.
And no shore patrol out. So I went right down to the ship right away. I got hold of one of the executive officers, and I says, is the captain around? He says, no, he's headquarters in the Baranoff Hotel. And I said, well, how come they got all these men out in the shore patrol? He says, well, he said, that's the way we do it. He said, we've been all over Seattle, Juneau, Seattle and Ketchikan, all over Sitka. We never put on any shore patrol. So I headed right up to the hotel and got a hold of the captain. And I told him, I said, Captain, I said, it's all these men loose. And I said, we got some other army, and we got all these natives, and we got a town full of roughnecks there, and we're going to have nothing but trouble. He said, you won't have any trouble. And I said, how come? Well, if you had paid any attention, listen to those loudspeakers off the ship. He says, I give instructions. He said, when they go to town, if one man's out of line, everybody goes back to that ship except the officers. If I lay out here 2 months, he says, not one of those men come ashore. He says, that's my orders. That's it. So I said, I hope it works out. And he says, well. So everything went fine until about 11 o'clock in the evening. We had down the old city camp we used to call the Bucket of Blood. Had a bar down there. And they'd line up there, 7, 8 in the line in that bar. Well, they had one of these young fellas off our engineers out here, who's 17 years old, and he was on duty as a shore patrol. And he got a few drinks in him, and he walked through this bar, and there was an officer sitting at the bar, and a kid struck this officer in the arm and knocked his drink over. Well, all the officer turned, he couldn't do anything about it, because he knew his orders from the ship. So all he said to this young fellow, he says, young man, he says, you behave yourself, and he says, watch what you're doing. Well, this kid took his club out and hit him on the head. Now, they took the whole front of that building out. Just took the whole works out in front. So I had to run up and I got a hold of the fire department. Had to go down, we had to hold them all down to settle it, you know.
Yeah.
And I got back up and I sent one of the boys up to the hotel and got a hold of the captain. In an hour, you couldn't see one man in the street. And they laid out there for 2 weeks and there wasn't a man except the officer come ashore.
Yes, sir.
That was his orders and that's it.
That was the end of it.
Yeah.
Good captain.
But boy, I tell you, we used these kids here now in this apartment now, they're on a pension compared to what we had.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Oh, man, that was, I say, we didn't have good army officers here. We'd been in a terrible fix.
Yeah.